Hello, this is Barbara Peters. Once again, I'm talking to Douglas Preston, who is here at the Poison Pan to sign Old Bones, the start of a fascinating new series. So, Doug, what do you think the winning formula that you have come up with in terms of protagonists for Old Bones might be?
Well, we have these two wonderful female characters, both of whom have worked with Pendergast on various investigations that he's done. But they don't know each other. They never run into each other. And that's Nora Kelly, who's an archaeologist who was first introduced in the Cabinet of Curiosities, and Corey Swanson, who is, well, she was introduced in Still Life with Crows. She was still a rebellious teenager at the time. And Pendergast kind of took her under his wing and mentored her and paid for her finishing up her high school education, paid for her college at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And Corey went to the FBI Academy, and he is now a newly minted FBI agent. So suddenly the idea occurred to us that Nora Kelly, the archaeologist, and Corey Swanson, the brand new FBI agent, might cooperate on a case together. And that's really how we decided to launch this new series.
So you've been writing the Pendergast for a very long time, and then recently you had a series with Gideon Crew, which was a different series. Wonderful guy, located home base in Santa Fe, had a physical challenge, went off to try to do things, and then you kind of tucked him away after three books, and we don't really know what will happen to him.
That's right. We kind of left Gideon Crew sitting on his porch in the Jemez Mountains of New Mexico with only possibly a few months to live. But we don't really know what's going to happen to him. And he may come back or he may pass away. Even Lincoln and I really don't know the answer to that. But we feel that that was an interesting series. We loved writing it. It was very exciting. Gideon Crew was totally different from Pendergast. We wanted to have a completely different character. But this series is different in the sense that it involves two characters who are well known already to our readers, who've been associated with Pendergast. And in fact, Pendergast is going to make a cameo appearance in each one of these novels. So the first one, Old Bones, he makes a cameo appearance at the very end to enormous effect. I can't say anything about it, but it's quite an outrageous and startling chapter.
So you basically created the Penderverse, right? In which various characters, Gideon was an aside from that because he didn't figure in the Pendergast novels, but you've got, you know, a number of characters. Unfortunately, we've lost, was it Bill Smithson, right?
Smithback,
yes. Sorry. And that, in fact, was a real blow to Nora, wasn't it?
It was a terrible blow. Nora was eventually married to him, and then he was murdered in the most ghastly way, and it was really tough on Nora. So she was working in New York at the Museum of Natural History at the time, so she went back to Santa Fe and resumed her position at the Santa Fe Institute of Archaeology, and that's where we see her now, today. And she's trying to get over the death of her husband, and she's really focused on work. In fact, she's immersed herself in work a little too much. And so this novel is sort of, well, it doesn't really get her out of the work world, but it shakes her up tremendously and hopefully helps her adjust a little bit better to her husband's death.
So you've created this fictional institute in Santa Fe.
That's right. It's not the Santa Fe Institute. It's the Santa Fe Institute of Archaeology. Different place.
Right. I just thought we'd get that in there so people won't go looking for it in Santa Fe. And so she's approached by an historian who has an interesting thesis about events that may have taken place during the tragedy of the Donner Party, who tried to cross the Sierras unwisely, took bad advice, and didn't execute it well, and got caught in a blizzard. And it's a famous story in the American West, with some gruesome Margaret Mead overtones, right, from
yes.
like New Guinea.
It's a terrible story. I think most Americans know it. This poor party of people, almost 100 people, were stranded in the high Sierras, where it snowed up to 26 feet on them, and they eventually, many of them starved to death or died of the cold, and the others had to resort to eating their friends, their relatives, and their traveling companions in order to survive. So it was a dreadful case of starvation cannibalism. Now, but what interested me, and I've been interested in this for a long time, was that two of these Donner camps have been discovered and excavated by archaeologists. And they found some really interesting information from excavating these camps that we didn't know about before. And I thought, what if there were a third camp, a lost camp? And Nora Kelly is approached by this fellow, Clive Benton, who has found Donner Journal, and the Donner Journal contains clues to where this lost camp might be. So they launch an expedition into the High Sierras to find the camp and to excavate it, and they do.
And we probably shouldn't say any more about what they actually find, but you know, when I was writing up this book for your many fans that shop for your books through the Poison Pen, I was thinking back to The Life of Pi. And the movie where the man adrift on the raft, you know, creates this mythical tiger. But when you get to the very end of it, you realize that it wasn't the tiger that ate all his raft mates. It was him. That's how he survived. And then the other night, I was watching a really terrific new detective show made by the French, who were doing wonderful things with mystery in television, called The Art of the Crime, and one of the episodes featured Sherry Cole's famous painting, The Raft of the Medusa, which you probably know was a horrendous shipwreck in which 120-some people were cast adrift on a raft. And to survive, those who were the most ferocious and determined murdered some of their companions and threw them overboard, but they also ate some of their companions. It's a horrible painting.
I know that painting. It's in the Louvre.
Yes, it
and
is.
It's a gigantic painting, an absolutely incredible painting.
Right, but it's a perfectly horrible story.
Yeah.
So, you know, literature or art has already touched upon various aspects of cannibalism. I think your book deals with it in a very scientific way and brings out some factors that maybe nobody has considered. We can't go into them without creating spoilers, but I thought with your scientific background that you did a really remarkable job in talking about it. But let's talk for a moment about an archaeologist as a sleuth, because Nora really, you know, is the lead detective, even though Corey shows up. She's too inexperienced at this point. And also, she doesn't have that specialized knowledge. So, do you see an archaeologist as basically being kind of detective?
Yes, and that's exactly how I see it. That's putting it very well. Both Lincoln and I come from families of archaeologists. Link's grandmother was a very well-known archaeologist who was named Nora, by the way. And my aunt was a famous underwater archaeologist. She was the first American woman underwater archaeologist, and she excavated a number of sites along the Greek and Italian coasts. So archaeology is in our background, but as you point out, archaeology and crime investigation are very similar. Archaeology is piecing together clues that have been scattered, that are disturbed, that are just traces of this and traces of that, and trying to piece together what happened. Who were these people? What did they think? Why did they do what they do? And that's exactly what a crime investigator does at the scene of a crime. Who was this person? Who was this murderer? Why did he do it? how did he do it? And many of the techniques are quite similar, actually. So combining the two, I think, makes for a very interesting combination and really a tremendous story possibilities.
I don't know that a lot of people realize that Agatha Christie, one, she was married, her second marriage, to a famous archaeologist, Max Mallowan, who was at Nimrud. Didn't you find out just a moment ago when we were talking? It was Nimrud. And I've seen that part of his work that is at the British Museum. But as a consequence of that, she met him somewhere out in the Middle East. She wrote several mysteries that involved archaeology. But if you really think about it, the structure of archaeology, and in that you are in a specific site that's relatively enclosed and so forth, is very much like an Agatha Christie country house murder.
It is.
It really is. You know, it's got a perimeter, and it's got stuff inside it, and the clues and what happened and all generally are going to be contained within that perimeter. So I thought about that when I was reading, you know, the third camp of the Donner Party, and the way that you depict it is very much like a country house murder, which could actually translate to a theater or a cabin on a ship or, you know, any enclosed environment.
It's a very interesting comment you just made, because that's exactly what it's like. It's like a closed room mystery, except that in this case, it takes place in a valley, shut in by high cliffs all around, except with one entrance where they were snowed in. And everything happened in that valley. You couldn't go very far. There was 26 feet of snow on the ground. So all these terrible things happened. And we don't want to say exactly what it was. Things worse than cannibalism, in a way, happen there, and that's what they discover when they excavate the site. But yes, it's like a closed room mystery.
Well, if there's no egress, in other words, those people couldn't get out, then theoretically there's no ingress either, that people couldn't get in.
Well, there's a true aspect to this story which is really fascinated me. Lincoln and I both did a lot of research on the Donner Party, and one of the stories that came out, this is all true, is there was a fellow named Wolfinger who was carrying gold. And he was murdered for his gold along the way by two others in the wagon train. And one of them confessed to the murder on his deathbed as he was dying of starvation when they were snowed in. And the other one also died of starvation. And there is no mention made of this gold by any of the rescuers. And I consulted many historical sources, and it doesn't appear that any historian is focused on the fact that here was a man murdered for his gold, and the two murderers died in these mountains. Well, where the heck is the gold? And that gave us the idea for kind of a subplot of this story, which is, where is the gold? And in fact, there's nothing fictional about that. It's quite possibly that gold was hidden somewhere up there and is still there. Because none of the rescuers, none of those parties, no one ever reported any gold. Although some of the rescuers did rob some of the people who died up in that valley, but they didn't. There's no mention of gold.
Well, I mean, what we have here is a wagon train of people who have taken all their possessions, everything that matters to them that they could, on their journey from, where'd they start, Missouri?
Yes.
From St. I think that was always the big kicking off point, was St. Louis, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
So they've traveled west, but the point is they're going to make a new life in California. And so they would take everything valuable with them that they could. So it wouldn't be surprising that when they died that their valuables, you know, would be there.
That's right. And in fact, this was an exceptionally wealthy wagon train. These people had a lot of money. They were not impoverished people looking to, to start new lives. They were bringing money with them because they expected to buy land, they expected to buy stores, and to found businesses in California.
It's really too bad that by taking a shortcut that was basically untested, they might have made it, except for this terrible snowstorm that arose at the very sort of end of the trail for them, you know. It was all.
Well, they would have actually made it, because at a certain point the group split.
Right.
One group continued on the regular trail, and the other group took this so-called shortcut, which was not a shortcut at all, and they're the ones who got caught in the mountains. The other group made it safely.
Right, no, I knew that. But even the group that got caught in the mountains were very close to getting out of the mountains, weren't they, before the storm hit?
Exactly. They were 3 miles from the pass. And if they just kept going, pushing all night long through the snowstorm, they might have made it. But they said, oh, we'll just wait this one out. It's a little snow, you know. We'll wait it out, and then we'll continue on tomorrow. Well, it snowed like 2 or 3 feet. And then they thought, well, we'll wait for the snow to melt a little bit, and then we'll get out. And of course, the snow never did melt. It just kept snowing and snowing, and finally 26 feet of snow piled up.
So it was a series of bad decisions, you know, that it didn't have to end in a tragedy. They could have, A, gone with the other party and ignored this advice about a shortcut, or B, as you say, they could have pushed on through the snow and made it to the pass, at which point it was downhill. So they probably could have pushed through.
Exactly, yeah.
And
they would have, that side of the Sierras is not that long. They, you know, as they were going downhill, they were going to lower and lower elevations quite rapidly.
Right, isn't the steep side on the Nevada side? It's on the east side, if I remember, because I've been in the Sierras.
Is that right?
I think so. I think that it's one of, you know, because they're formed by the Pacific Plate, you know, pushing up against, and I think that the east side is the steeper side, and the California side is where
it's more gentle.
Slopes down. So they might very well, as you say, if they just pushed on, could have made it. So did you really investigate the leadership of this group? I mean, who was in charge that made these poor decisions?
Well, we did. And they were made really by George Donner and the Reed family. There were a couple of men who sort of made these decisions on it for everyone's benefit. It was kind of a democracy, but as they struggled through this shortcut, which turned out, you know, across the Great Salt Desert and through the Wasatch Mountains, and they realized they were falling more and more behind, and they started to starve, and they didn't have water, and the poor children were given bullets to chew on because they didn't have any water, and that was the only way to comfort them in their thirst. As this progressed, there was a breakdown in the social order, and a man was murdered, not just Wolfinger, but another man, and another man was put out of the wagon train because he was ill and they didn't want to deal with him. They put him out. I mean, so there was a social breakdown. It was almost like a Lord of the Flies situation where nobody was in charge anymore, and it was everyone kind of looking out for themselves.
That would explain a great deal then of what happened. I mean, if they had one strong leader, then they might still have pushed through.
That's right, yeah, but and then they were, you know, the Indians were firing arrows at them and picking off their oxen and killing their horses and just terrifying them. And, you know, the Indians naturally were not happy with seeing these people invade their territory. So it was sort of the pioneer image, the great pioneer legend, turned inside out.
Do you think the fact that they were wealthier than the average wagon train person might have made them overconfident in it? They thought that maybe bad things couldn't happen to people like them?
Yes, I think that's a very interesting psychological insight. They were very confident. They were leaders in their communities. Back in the East, in the, you know, Midwest, they were men of means, and they weren't really toughened, hard scrabble, you know, pioneers. They weren't soft exactly, and they were certainly hardened over this long journey, but they just, you know, didn't quite have the absolute guts that it would have taken for them to survive.
Well, I was also thinking about their judgment, because, you know, if you're in a party going through inhospitable land dominated by people who are shooting arrows at you and so forth, why would you want to break off? and be a splinter group, even if it were a shortcut, surely safety would have lain better with staying with a larger party.
Absolutely. So, well, it made sense to do the tried and true route. They were not, you know, necessarily so far behind schedule that they really had to do the shortcut. They just thought it was going to make it easier on them. They were looking for something that, you know, for an easier way to go. It was cutting corners in a way.
Well, that was my point, is that they were people who, insulated somewhat from life shocks, probably thought that easier would be the better way to go. Well, I think it's a fascinating story. I think it's certainly one of your strongest plots, and I really do like the two women and their dynamic together. And I forgot to mention that you start out, well, let's not go into it and do any spoilers, but you actually open this book with a series of grave robberies that are particularly gruesome. So we already know that there's something else going on, but we're not sure what. And I thought you did that science plot, part of the plot, very well.
Well, thank you. Yeah, Lincoln and I have always been interested in grave robbing.
Okay, well, I won't pursue that. So you're planning on, how are you going forward? We have a new Pendergast coming, we already know, on February 4th, and it's called?
Crooked River.
Great title.
It is. It's actually a river in the Florida Panhandle. It's a real place. And it's, I can't really say why the book is named that, but suffice to say, terrible things happen on the Crooked River.
Well, there are always terrible things that happen when Pendergast is around. But then, are you planning, what's your schedule going to be for Nora and Corey? Are you going to try to do two books a year, or are you going to take like 9 months between, or what are you going
to
do?
Well, it's usually about 9 months. It's hard for us to write two books a year. It's too fast. But we have already got an idea for the next Nora Kelly, Corey Swanson book.
Okay.
And it takes place in New Mexico. And it opens, I'll just throw out the first chapter, which may not be end up being the first chapter in the novel, I don't know. But anyway, it opens with the discovery of a mummified body in the basement of a ruined whorehouse in a ghost town in the mountains outside of Carrizozo, New Mexico.
Wow, terrific premise.
And so the FBI are called in because the 70-year-old corpse, they don't know this person was murdered or died there from natural causes or what happened to this person, but it could be a homicide. So the FBI, you know, routinely called in on something like this. There's a reason why the FBI is actually called in specifically. And so Corey is the rookie FBI agent assigned to this case, and she asked Nora Kelly to recover the body for her and do it in a careful archaeological fashion so that no clues are lost. And so as Nora recovers this mummified body, she finds something on the body that's absolutely unbelievable. And that's where the novel begins.
Well, it sounds terrific. So you're winding up probably in October, finishing the February Pendergast, and then do you guys just leap right into a new book, or do you give yourself a little holiday, or what do you do?
We leap right into the new book. We generally take a holiday in the middle of writing the book, rather than in between books.
Okay.
So we will sometimes start the next book the very next day, and in fact, with the new Nora Kelly book, we've already written a bunch of chapters.
Oh, that's exciting. Yeah. So you've also done a number of books on your own, and so does Lincoln. So Lincoln, I'm assuming, is working on his, I never can say this name right, Enigmologist, that's it.
Enigmologist.
Yeah, there are too many eology books here, but anyway, so his Enigmologist, and that's a series I really like. He's written, what, three of them or four? Four, maybe.
I think four, yeah.
And he goes to interesting, you know, I love the one that was set in Egypt in the Sudan. So he carries on in that series with some of the themes that you write about together.
Yeah.
And you've written a number of different things, but you've been writing more nonfiction recently.
I am. I had a great success with The Lost City of the Monkey God. And so
yes,
my
you
publisher
did.
Is saying, when are you going to come out with another nonfiction book? But, you know, nonfiction ideas, are good ones, are very hard to come by. You have to wait. You can't just, like, make something up or try to dig out something. You've got to wait for that absolutely fabulous idea to come. And I've got a couple of things I'm researching and working on, and we'll see what happens.
And let's see, in June, you were here because your 1995 nonfiction book, Talking to the Ground, which I've always loved, in which you and your now wife and daughter go by horseback around the Navajo Four Corners, so around Navajo country, has been republished. So that gives you Cities of Gold, which was the first book we ever did together. And that was a horseback ride from the Mexican border up through Arizona in search of the Cities of Gold, right?
That's right.
And then you did Talking to the Ground. You also wrote a book, El Camino Royal, wasn't it? About
That's
the
right.
Royal Road in Santa Fe, the one that goes down through the Jornada del Muerto and on to Mexico.
That's right. And I rode the Jornada del Muerto, which in Spanish means the journey of the dead man. I rode that section of trail on horseback. That was very interesting. That's a really dangerous, empty desert in New Mexico, and that's why they called it the Journey of the Dead Man, or the Journey of Death.
Well, all three of those books you wrote, that I mentioned, you rode on horseback. You rode on horseback in Cities of Gold. You certainly rode on horseback around the Four Corners, and then in that one. Are you still riding a lot?
I do. I ride, but I don't ride long distance like that anymore. That's very physically very hard on your body. I mean, that Cities of Gold trip was 10 weeks riding 12 hours a day.
And wrangling besides.
And wrangling these horses across this landscape where sometimes you didn't even have a tree branch to tie them up to. So, and then keeping them together and not losing them and not having them run away. That was really hard.
So you've gotten soft with the writer's life, way too much time at your desk and not in the saddle, huh?
That's right. Well, I've gotten older. I was happy. In fact, that was exactly 30 years ago that we did that trip following Coronado's route, looking for the Seven Cities of Gold. And I was 33. I was in good physical shape. I think it'd kill me now.
Well, as somebody slightly your senior, actually a lot your senior, I would certainly agree with that. But I'm hoping that a great nonfiction idea will come to you, but I'm really excited about this book and about the next Pendergast. And you've obviously got a new Corey and Nora on the boil. So a lot of good things happening, right?
We do. We're always working. It's got to put food on the table.
Well, and it also means you get to come to Scottsdale, you and I get to hang out, have dinner, and do podcasts.
I love that. That's my favorite part of any book tour, is coming to Scottsdale.
Well, thank you, Doug. It's certainly one of our highlights of every year. Thanks very much for talking to me.